Thank you for supporting WBEZ. You keep public media public. December gifts are among the most important because they set the tone for our reporting in 2026. Next year, we're doubling down on bringing you stories that arm you with the facts. This journalism relies on everyone contributing what they can. Join them today at wbez.org/donate.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work blends classroom learning with extensive field education guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work. Inspire change. Shape the future.
A pope of many firsts and a champion of the poor and marginalized, Pope Francis has died at the age of 88. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Pope Francis is known for changing the direction of the Roman Catholic Church, prioritizing inclusion over traditional doctrine and pushing for transparency. He had the ear of migrants, victims of sexual abuse by Catholic clergy members, and championed care for the planet. After a month-long hospitalization for pneumonia, it seemed like the Jesuit Pope was bouncing back. He even blessed crowds on Easter, so his death just a day later is taking some by surprise. To start our discussion of his death and his legacy, we turn to Stephen Millies, professor of public theology and director of the Bernardin Center at the Catholic Theological Union. Stephen began with his reaction to the news.
Well, there's tremendous sadness together with surprise, of course. And yet at the same time, for as much as I've spoken to people about it over the last few hours, I'm struck on the one hand by a certain gratitude for his life and for his ministry, a remarkable public witness of what we believe and a remarkable accompaniment of the whole world of people who believe all sorts of things. But I'm also, I will say too, in this Easter season, I'm struck by a certain feeling of joy for Pope Francis, who now has the reward that he earned in his life as a pastor for billions of people. His death came suddenly and swiftly. That is a grace, perhaps we can say. Mm-hmm. And now he has the reward of what we believe.
You said gratitude for his life. And of course, we're not just talking about the 88 years on this planet, but those 12 years, of course, as the leader of the Roman Catholic Church. Talk to us about how much he changed the church, Stephen.
Well, that's a funny kind of question. The church, you know, changes constantly. The church, of course, also is constant. No pope really changes anything fundamentally, and yet every pope brings enormous changes with them. When I think about Pope Francis, I think I would want to say this. I avoid words like progressive or conservative or liberal or traditional. I think of Pope Francis, of his pastoral emphasis, he was very much like in that direct way that he communicated with people. Mm-hmm. He was like people's pastors, like the priest or the minister in the church down the road, who knew what life was like and spoke to us that way. Every pope has both a pastoral side and a doctrinal side. We've been very accustomed, I would say, in the last 40 or 50 years for popes who emphasize the doctrinal more than the pastoral. Francis emphasized the pastoral, I think, a little more than the doctrinal. He had both, but I think that's the difference that we notice from where we are today as we look back across the papacies we've known more recently.
Yeah, he took so much emphasis on caring for the poor, right? That was everything that he was about. It was very important to him. Why do you think that was?
Well, because that's what the gospel says. That's the very important thing to remember, is that caring for the poor, and the poor understood in a very broad, a very wide sense, anyone who is vulnerable, anyone who is in a marginal situation. And so that would include the migrant or the immigrant. That would include the LGBTQ+ person. That would include people in any situation where they are threatened. That's the fundamental call of the gospel. For the Holy Father to bear such public and firm witness to that is both inspiring and yet, on the other hand, totally unsurprising.
Mm-hmm. This morning, on Morning Edition, right here on WBEZ, we spoke with Cardinal Blaise Supich, Archbishop of Chicago. Here's a little bit of what he had to say.
He was chosen to take on the role that he did in the life of the church as an ordained person because he himself experienced the mercy of God. And he wanted everybody else to also have that experience so that they would show mercy to one another. Our world is a lot better off when we cut each other a little bit of slack, when we give another person another chance, when we show mercy. So many of the conflicts in the world and in our own families can be overcome if we follow that way of that he offered to us.
Yeah, he says he showed mercy. In a lot of ways, it sort of echoes what you said a moment ago about a lot of his actions weren't surprising, right? It was in the gospel, but so there were no surprises that he would be this way. Talk more about his demeanor and his particular approach.
Well, I'm struck as I listen to Cardinal Supich by Pope Francis's motto, having mercy, he called him. It's from the gospel for the calling of St. Matthew, who was a tax collector. Jesus, having mercy, called him to be one of his apostles. The notion of Pope Francis's own feeling of unworthiness as a sinner, I think should sit very, very high in our own imagining of this as we think about it here retrospectively. In his first interview after he was elected Pope, he was asked, who is Jorge Mario Bergoglio? And his answer, his first words were, I am a sinner. He was very aware of that. When a Christian, when anyone begins from that beginning, it's hard to feel better than anyone else. And it is, in Cardinal Supich's wonderful way of putting it, a wonderful way to be reminded that we need to give each other a little slack sometimes.
Mm-hmm. He advocated for a more inclusive church. You mentioned earlier LGBTQ people, right? Pope Francis once said, who am I to judge? Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking this morning particularly about a comparison between that Pope Francis's openness and welcome toward LGBTQ plus persons and the way in which 60 years ago this year, the church acknowledged its historic role in antisemitism around the world. We're observing the 60th anniversary this year of Nostra Aetate, the document that opened the door in the Second Vatican Council to the church's engagement with Jewish and other peoples of other faiths. That was a very difficult thing to acknowledge. Pope John Paul II went to the Wailing Wall in 2000 and apologized for the church's role historically in antisemitism. But I'm thinking of it in comparison to Francis's openness to LGBTQ plus people simply because it is again a recognition not only that there are marginal people who need our care and our attention and our welcome and our accompaniment, but there are marginal people that we, the church, have helped to make more marginal. That's a very important acknowledgement. It's something we have to own up to honestly. We have to look at that firmly. Pope Francis, I think, encouraged us to do that. He showed us how to do that.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier that you didn't like to sort of box in description into categories like conservative or liberal. Talk more about that, where that comes from, and just whether, in turn, he did have a wide support among Catholics.
Well, I think I could talk for quite a while about that, actually, but part of the reason certainly is because that's a terminology that comes from political history. It's a sort of an instinctive way that we categorize people. We put a label on it, and it helps make it easier for us to talk about and think about people. But even in politics, we know that those labels reach a point of no longer being helpful. And the church, you know, certainly has political dimensions, but there are all sorts of reasons then why those labels, I think, are quite unhelpful in the context of talking about things inside the church. We're better to focus on that distinction between the pastoral and the doctrinal, which are, of course, two sides of the same coin. Mm-hmm. They're the same thing. And that's also rather different from thinking about an opposition between two different things, liberals and conservatives or whatever.
We're going to add Mary Fiorito to the conversation now. She's an attorney as well as a former top aide to Cardinal George. He's the late predecessor to Cardinal Blaise Supich, that's the Archbishop of Chicago. Hi, Mary. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Sasha. Thank you for having me.
How are you feeling today, Mary, with that news?
Well, you know, it's a very kind of mixed emotions. We knew the Holy Father was ill. You could even see yesterday in, you know, his last public experiences, how tired he looked. He looked very drawn. Cardinal Dolan, the Archbishop of New York, said this morning, you couldn't have scripted a more perfect, beautiful death. I mean, he went to the Lord after celebrating the Lord's resurrection, and his final words from his message to the world, it's a message that's traditionally given every Easter called the Urbi et Orbi to the church and to the world. He said, Christ fills us with the certainty that we too are called to share in the life that knows no end. So celebrating that fact that Jesus died to save us, and that guarantees eternal life for all of us. And what a beautiful way, with proclaiming that message, that he himself goes very quietly and peacefully in his own bed at home the way he wanted to, but with such a powerful witness at the end.
And speaking of messages, we've been talking about his focus on the poor, caring for the environment, being inclusive. What is your take, Mary, on what he focused on during his tenure? What did he get right?
My goodness, he tackled so many things in a very kind of direct way. You know, it's said that St. Thomas Aquinas once pointed out that, you know, grace builds on nature. And I think we have in the nature of Pope Francis a very strong, determined, sort of fiery temperament type of person. And so when he spoke on issues, whether it was in defense of the unborn or in defense of migrants looking for a better way of life, you know, he could speak in very kind of direct and straightforward terms. Sometimes that would turn people off, unfortunately, and the message got lost in a little bit of that. But I think it was good that he wanted to draw people's attention back to the poorest of the poor in particular. And I think we as Americans really need to hear that message, because we are surrounded by such wealth, you know, compared to the third world countries. And so it's good for us to have those reminders that, you know, even our poor here that we would think would be poor in Chicago and New York and other big cities, it's not poverty compared to what some people in third world nations are experiencing. So, you know, the first pope to come from Latin America, the first Jesuit pope, right, with a vow of poverty, he really brought all of those experiences into his papacy, and I think really helped sort of the average first world Catholic to grow in that regard.
What do you think he perhaps got wrong, Mary? Anything that he did that maybe caused consternation for you?
Well, I mean, I don't know if it was consternation for me personally, but he could, I think just because of his temperament, he would speak sometimes with a lack of theological precision. And again, it's just sort of more the South American way. He would make certain statements without, you know, unlike Pope Benedict, who was a very, you know, precise intellectual theologian, everything, you know, was well thought out before he said it. I think the Holy Father kind of spoke sometimes off the cuff. And rather than lending clarity to issues, sometimes particularly contentious issues, it could cause confusion. And then there would have to be a statement that would come out afterwards, you know, where the Holy Father would then clarify, you know, his statements. You know, he was giving these famous press conferences on the plane, you know, and just sometimes making comments without realizing the way in which they could be manipulated or taken out of context down the line.
Right.
So, again, it's not, it's just, it's a personality and temperament thing. He was a very holy man. He brought the church again face to face with issues, I think, that perhaps had maybe been backburnered a bit in terms of our, you know, focus on them. And I'm grateful now that he was able to have such a beautiful death at home and to go on Easter Monday. Again, you couldn't have scripted a better ending.
Right. As I mentioned, you worked for the Archdiocese of Chicago. Now, that was for nearly three decades. You were also the first woman to serve as the vice chancellor. Mary, you were part of the local process of responding to papal vacancies. What does that look like on the local level?
Well, the day of the death will begin what is called Novendiales, which is the 9 days of mourning, and that will happen worldwide. Whether you're in Chicago or you're in Rome, the whole church will go into a period of mourning. Generally, what happens is that black bunting or black and purple bunting will be placed over all the major buildings in the archdiocese, from the archbishop's residence to our cathedral, and then to some of the other important buildings. Many parishes do that as well, individually. It is possible that bells will be rung at the same time, perhaps as they did in France 88 times to mark his 88 years. There's a whole sort of process and ritual that now kicks in, obviously beginning with prayer, right? And so as we now work towards the Holy Father's funeral, that needs to happen 4 to 6 days from the death of the Holy Father. So I've already heard that the canonization of Blessed Carlos Octus, who was a young Italian computer programmer. He was only 15 or 16 when he died. He was going to be made a saint this weekend by the Holy Father on the 27th. And they had already given out 300,000 tickets for that particular event.
Oh, wow.
And that's now been canceled. Oh, yes, he's very popular. Carlos Acutis is worldwide. And so you have all these pilgrims who are already making their way to Rome for that. So that's now been canceled. So my understanding is that the funeral will likely take place either Friday or Saturday. And that's also to give the cardinals from around the world ample time to get there. The other thing to remember about Pope Francis is that he made cardinals from different areas, Sri Lanka and other areas of the world that previously hadn't had cardinals. And so for some of those men, it's going to take them a little longer time to get there and to get things together. Mm-hmm. And then within 15 days, the papal conclave has to begin, 15 to 20 days.
I see.
They may stretch that out to the 20-day mark just to give everyone from around the globe, quite literally, ample time to get there.
Yeah. So could local parishes in Chicago have any influence on who eventually becomes the next pope?
Well, through their prayers, any Catholic can have influence. We need to just pray that the Lord will help the cardinals to see what he wants for the church in this next generation, and to pray very hard that the Holy Spirit will be speaking through the cardinals' votes.
That's Mary Fiorito, a former top aide to Cardinal George. Thank you so much for checking in, Mary.
Thank you so much, Sasha. Have a good day.
Still with us, Stephen Millies of the Catholic Theological Union. You were, of course, listening to my conversation there with Mary Fiorito. Could we see, here's a question for you, Stephen, an American pope? Maybe a pope from Chicago?
There's an old saying inside the church that he who enters the conclave a pope and exits as a cardinal. There's not much to be gained by speculating about things like this. I will say this, that throughout the course of certainly as long as I've been alive, the wisdom has always been that no pope could come from a great world power like the United States, that we wouldn't want the confusion of when the mm-hmm. church speaks. We wouldn't want the confusion that would arise from having an American from this great military and economic superpower speaking with the authority of the Vatican. That being said, I often wonder in these days, as we see the rising trends of authoritarianism around the whole globe, my mind goes to considering the politics of the United States as they are today. My mind goes to the 1978 election of Karol Wojtyła from behind the Iron Curtain. Might it be possible for an American to be elected in this time because of the mm-hmm. politics of the United States, because of what's happening around the world? World events are always with the cardinals inside the conclave. It's part of their deliberation. It's mm-hmm. part of that prayerful deliberation that Mary was talking about. What role this moment that we are living through now will play?
This is a particularly challenging moment.
It raises interesting possibilities.
Yeah. Before we take a pause, let's hear from a caller who's reaching out from Wheaton. Here's Bill. Hey, Bill, welcome to the show. What are your thoughts?
Hey, thank you. I'm reflecting on the globalization of the church and the impact of different cultures. My reflection was, and the reason for my call, a life-changing experience for me personally was in 1968. I made my first international trip as an 18-year-old. And I was there in Bogota, Colombia, for the first papal visit to Latin America. This was the Eucharistic Congress in Bogota, Colombia, in the summer of 1968. And I'm hoping other listeners who might be from Colombia or might be from Latin America might remember that event. It was so significant because here, Latin America has the greatest population of Roman Catholics, yet a pope had never visited the continent mm-hmm. until that year, 1968. And now this pope, whom we are celebrating, was born in Latin America. So, as many have noted, he's the first Latin American man to be pope, and it was 50-some years ago that the first pope made a visit to that continent. Yeah. That's what I want.
Lots to reflect on.
How significant that moment was in my life mm-hmm. and how it was life-changing. And here we are celebrating a pope who is from the Latin American mm-hmm. continent.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing your reflections with us, Bill. Joining us now on the program, Reverend Michael Trail from St. Thomas the Apostle Catholic Church in Hyde Park. Welcome to the show, Reverend.
Thanks so much for having me.
What's your reaction to the news of the Pope's death?
I mean, obviously sadness and shock, given the fact that just yesterday we celebrated the joy of Easter and we're still in the middle of the Easter season, to learn of Pope Francis' passing this morning, obviously just in the midst of just so much sadness, in the midst of joy. But I don't know, in many ways, I think I think no one can ever plan when one passes away, but I think it's almost appropriate that Pope Francis passed away just the day after Easter, because I think what he tried to do was be a Pope of joy for the people. And and so even in the midst of sadness, I think even in the midst of his death, you know, he was in the middle of joy around Easter.
Yeah. Tell me how that joy sort of influenced you from Pope Francis, the way that you work with parishioners and how you interact with everyday people.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So, I mean, Pope Francis was elected when I was in the seminary. And so his pontificate and his influence has really marked my entire ministry as a priest. And I think what he's modeled for me is just being close to the people, you know, not keeping the people at arm's length, but really embracing all of God's people and every different shade and facet and aspect of life, and just inviting them to have a loving relationship with Jesus, but then also to having them incorporated into the part of the community. You know, Pope Francis, you know, throughout his pontificate, you know, he worked so hard just to bring people into the fold. You know, he went out to the margins, worked with people and encountered people who were, who did not have a voice, and brought a voice to the voiceless, and really raised the people who are on the margins. And I think that's been a highlight for me, and something I've tried to do in my own life and ministry as a priest here at St. Thomas.
How inspiring. Reverend Michael Trail, thank you so much for checking in with us.
You're welcome.
Let's turn now to WBEZ's Adora Namigade, who's been checking in on Catholic parishes all morning. Where have you been, Adora?
Hey, Sasha. So I started out on the west side where I live, and then I came downtown. So I went to St. John Bosco in Hermosa. I went to St. Stanislaus Casa, which I believe is in Wicker Park. You can check me on that. It might be Bucktown. And now I'm in St. Peter's in the Loop, which is downtown.
So what have you been finding? How's the news of Pope Francis' death resonating here with Chicagoans?
Yeah, I think a lot of Catholics are reacting, even if they're not coming out to church specifically. Out on the west side, things kind of looked normal, but priests did say that they'll be adding the Pope's death and the repose of his soul to their intention. Downtown, there are a lot more people, especially because this parish, St. Peter's in the Loop, is kind of catered to office workers downtown. So a lot of people have been going in and out. I did also meet people who came out here specifically because the Pope died.
Okay. As expected, right?
You know, it depends. I mean, for some people, they do feel like, okay, I have the time and this death moves me to come out to a church specifically. For other people, like I myself am Catholic, Sasha.
Yes.
I'm in a ton of group chats about this, and people are shocked. People are paying their condolences, but they're not necessarily going to church as a result.
That's good insight. Thank you. WBEZ's Adora Namigade.
You're welcome.
Stephen Millies is still here in studio, professor of public theology and director of the Bernardine Center at the Catholic Theological Union. We are also still taking your calls. Let's just jump real quick to Nancy in Winnetka. Hey, Nancy. Thank you for joining us.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Your thoughts?
What I'm sitting with are a few things, and you have intellectuals that listen to you, and I really enjoy learning from history. So immediately my thoughts went to Pope John Paul II, and next week is his anniversary of his death when he died on Divine Mercy, which was created by him. And what Divine Mercy is when any of your sins are forgiven. And I could draw a lot of comparison to him and to Pope Francis, and I think they'll be remembered in the same regard, because Pope Francis also started this Hope of Jubilee year, which is very significant in the Catholic Church. And Pope John Paul, we had also a jubilee year with him as well, 25 years ago. That was the last one. And the other comparison I want to draw from then to now is that we're still fighting authoritarian regimes. We're still fighting fascism. So Pope John Paul II actually gave a speech in Warsaw about the importance of solidarity. Mm-hmm. And if you remember, the solidarity movement came because Russia was controlling Poland at the time, and they were communists. And what resonates with me today are the similarities that we are all, the major religions are all descendants from Abraham, whether it's you're Muslim, Jewish, or Catholic. And yet there's still such division.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that there's still a lot of spiritual warfare. There really is true evil out there. And with me, for Pope Francis, another comparison to history that I wanted to let your readers know, I'm reading right now The Pope at War, The Secret History of Pius XII, Mussolini, and Hitler. And it's absolutely fascinating. It's written by David Kurtzer. And what's interesting about then to now, what David had identified are some of the secret documents that were in the Vatican that Pope Francis released. And I think it says a lot about how he was also seeking truth and what the true message of the Bible is. And what comes out of this book is that Pope Pius XII was really concerned about saving the Vatican over saving the people.
That's a book that we'll definitely have to put on our reading list for sure. Stephen, you were listening along there, nodding as Nancy was speaking. Can you put some of that into further context for us?
Well, I'm struck again by the comparison between Pope Francis and Pope John Paul II. A couple of things leap out. One, certainly both were very different, but still both very skillful communicators. The papacy has become, across the last 50 or 60 years, the papacy has become a creature of the media age. And the papacy in this way is a sort of a global pastorate. Look, here we are on public radio, not Catholic radio, talking about the death of Pope Francis. And so this is very important. Pope John Paul was trained as an actor. Pope Francis didn't have that training, but he certainly always knew where the camera was and had a way of delivering a soundbite. And just one last thing I'd say quickly is I'm struck by the way, if we think about the long history of Roman Catholicism for the last three or four centuries, by the idea that the Roman Catholic Church today is perhaps one of the most important defenders of political liberty on the globe. It is an ironic turn of events, but it's certainly one that resonates with the ministries of both Pope John Paul and Pope Francis.
Yeah. He was an advocate for migrants at a time when the world's facing a migrant crisis. I want to play a little bit of what he had to say in the lead up to the U.S. presidential election last November.
You cannot decide. I can't say. I am not American. I'm not going to vote there. But let it be clear, sending away migrants, not allowing them to work, not sheltering them, is a sin. It's serious.
Stephen, what else can you share about his stance on migration?
Well, again, I go back to what I said earlier, that in his letter to the U.S. bishops, sort of sideways responding to what Vice President Vance had to say about the Ordo Amoris now about 2 months ago, Pope Francis again recurred to the parable of the Good Samaritan as the model for how we are meant to respond. And what he's telling us when he speaks about migrants and immigrants today in 2025 is that the beaten person lying on the side of the road, whoever they are, that is the person who commands our immediate attention. That's who we owe something to. And it's because of a word the last caller used, the word solidarity, which is, again, a line of connection between Pope John Paul and Pope Francis. It's the heart of Catholic social teaching that asks us to see we are not isolated individuals. We all owe things to one another because of our shared humanity. But what that means is that the most vulnerable of us make the loudest and most insistent and most urgent demands on our care.
So tell us what's next. As Mary Fioriti outlined for us earlier, this is now the 9-day period of mourning that begins for Catholics. Mourning, a funeral eventually. Conclave?
Yep, there will be a funeral. I hadn't seen any reporting about the timing yet, but that all sounds about right. The conclave, I would expect to, on about a 3-week horizon, we'll see how the timing of all of that goes. Between the funeral and the conclave will be a period of time called the General Congregations, when the cardinals will have meetings with one another. And this is an opportunity for the cardinals to talk with one another about the great issues that are in front of the church today. It's also a way of warming up to the papal election because they are listening to one another, praying together, sharing meals together. This is the place where the first consensuses about who might be the new pope begin to form. That'll take place between the funeral and the beginning of the conclave.
We have been talking with Stephen Millies, who's professor of public theology and director of the Bernardin Center at the Catholic Theological Union. Thank you so much for spending your morning with us.
Thank you very much.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by the Reset team. It was mixed by Ari Mejia and edited by Dan Tucker. Reset brings you thoughtful conversations on breaking news. Support what we do? Well, drop a like or subscribe to the podcast. We drop new episodes every weekday with a special episode on Saturdays. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk again soon.
My name is Donald. I live on the southeast side of Chicago. I support WBEZ because of the balanced reporting and covering so much about an issue as opposed to just the few seconds that you may hear on most other news outlets. It matters to me to hear the story more completely